So, Brittany, I have a question for you.
Okay.
Have you ever been in a Waymo, like those self-driving cars?
Okay, I have seen a lot of Waymos, but I have never been in a Waymo. I've seen a lot on a trip to Los Angeles I took last year. Me as a driver, like I was freaked out to see them on the road, like, you know, a car with nobody in the front seat. So I have yet to get inside one. I'm still kind of scared. What about you?
No, same. I rode in a Waymo only once in my life. Oh. And it was like a Final Destination fever dream, honestly.
Oh my gosh, that sounds horrifying. What do you mean Final Destination? What do you mean by that?
It just went against all of my driving instincts. I live in LA, and everyone knows the LA left turn, where you speed up and enter the middle of the intersection even when it's yellow.
Mm-hmm.
But the Waymo slowed down, and it just felt wrong. Like, it didn't match the vibe of any other driver on the road.
Sam, before we get any further, I have to introduce you to our lovely listeners. Everyone, this is Sam Mallari. She is a network content strategy manager on the NPR member partnership team. Oh, that's a lot of powerful words together.
It's a tongue twister. You did good. Basically, it means I'm the messenger between NPR and our 243 member stations that make up the NPR network.
Ooh, I love that. But anyway, back to Waymos.
Yes, they are everywhere. People used to say that the LA car was a Prius, but I think Waymos have kind of taken over. And ever since my only experience in one, I kind of ignored them. Until I came across a shocking piece of news through my Filipino corner of the internet.
What did you see?
So basically, Waymo's chief safety officer, Mauricio Peña, was in a Senate hearing in February about the safety of autonomous vehicles. Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey asked him if the cars use human assistance.
Senator, they provide guidance. They do not remotely drive the vehicles. As you stated, Waymo asked for guidance in certain situations. That is just one additional input.
But the human being helps the vehicle to navigate those difficult driving scenarios. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
He didn't give any specifics on how many are abroad.
No, we have some in the U.S. and some abroad.
So how does that break down? What percent are abroad?
Senator, I don't have that number for you. We can get back to you.
Markey pressed Peña further about the location of these remote workers.
In what countries are these employees located?
The Philippines.
Excuse me?
The Philippines.
So I really only found out about this because I started seeing these videos of people sitting in Waymos talking to the car in Tagalog.
Pas safe drive naman po para walang danger, ha? Tsaka...
Like trying to say hi to the remote workers they thought might be listening and even pretending that they're greeting family in the Philippines.
I mean, I have to say, those videos do sound kind of funny, but this whole thing just raises so many questions in my mind about how these cars actually work. Like, it doesn't fully surprise me that a car with no driver would need some kind of human guidance, but I wasn't expecting that the humans would be guiding from, like, another continent. And it's also interesting that this information came out through a Senate hearing when all the messaging around Waymos is about how smart the cars are and how safe the AI is that operates them.
Right. And I'm not surprised it's Filipino workers specifically. A lot of Filipino workers work in call centers for American companies. And there's a history of outsourcing tech labor to that country for a lot of reasons. One of which is that the Philippines is a former American colony.
Hmm.
But this story also just got me thinking about what you said, Brittany, that there's this narrative AI does everything by itself. For the record, Waymo maintains that its cars are autonomous and that humans don't guide or steer their vehicles, and that the system basically just reaches out when it might need a second opinion. But Waymo doesn't deny they still need human oversight sometimes. There's something here about the human labor that powers AI and the lack of transparency behind who exactly does it.
Hello, hello. I'm Brittany Luce, and you're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR, a show about what's going on in culture and why it doesn't happen by accident. Since my chat with Sam, I haven't been able to look at an AI tool without wondering if its radical output is the result of technology or the human touch. To dig deeper into the human labor behind AI, I'm here with Regine Cabato, a freelance journalist based in the Philippines. She co-wrote a piece for the Washington Post a couple years ago about AI laborers there. Hey, Regine.
Hi, Brittany.
and Ulises Mejias, professor at SUNY Oswego and co-author of the book Data Grab, The New Colonialism of Big Tech and How to Fight Back. Welcome, Ulises.
Happy to be here.
So happy to have you both. For listeners who don't know, just how much human labor goes into powering AI?
Well, yes, of course, when we hear the term artificial intelligence, we sort of think that, well, because it's artificial, it must mean that, you know, there's a lot of computers behind it, and humans don't really do a lot of labor. But the reverse is actually true. As I'm sure we will hear also from Regine, there is a lot of human labor that goes into training AI systems, into operating them, all of the data that needs to be fed into these systems usually needs to be categorized, labeled, tagged by human beings. And then once the systems are operating, they do involve quite a bit of human supervision that is actively needed to make sure the systems are operating correctly.
Regine, what does this look like in the Philippines?
In the Philippines in particular, there are at least a couple of million people who perform what we call quote-unquote crowd work. And for one company in particular that we looked into back in 2023, which was Scale AI, which provides data to big ticket clients such as the U.S. Department of Defense, Meta, Microsoft. However, at the time that we were doing this investigation back in 2023, there were already a lot of complaints about not being paid on time and just being paid the pittance compared to the work that they were signing up for.
And what is the work these crowd workers are actually doing on the day-to-day?
Basically, what these workers do is this thing called data annotation or data labeling. Mm-hmm. So for an AI to learn, for example, that color is blue, they need to get fed thousands of different colors, and they have to learn through the annotation of humans that this color is blue, this color is red, this color is yellow. And these have to be manually sorted by humans. So say, for example, if a system is a self-driving car, workers in the Philippines would get fed a map, for example, or an image of a street, and they have to tag on the image, this is a crosswalk, this is a traffic light, this is a tree, this is a sidewalk. And when all of that thousands of pictures all get tagged, that data set then gets sold to a company in the U.S.
Okay, you know, like when you're on a website sometimes and like they want to test to see if you're a human, they say, and you got to be like, this is a bicycle, this is a street lamp, this is a motorcycle. Is it like that?
Yes, yes.
You're right. It's exactly what some of us have encountered when we do the CAPTCHA.
I find those extremely irritating and annoying to do, but I can only imagine doing that kind of labor over and over and over and over and over again for hours on end for, you know, what it sounds like some people have described as like a pittance.
Yeah. Some of them would only get paid like in the tens of dollars, actually.
For hours of work?
Yes.
Oh, okay. So we've reached out to Scale AI and they've said that they've implemented changes to support pay transparency and consistency for their contributors. And that since your reporting, there are fewer CAPTCHA-like tasks and more complex data annotation work being done more often in the U.S. But they did confirm that the more generalist work still is being done in the Philippines, though they say it's much less than in the past. And I've also read that beyond Scale, that same kind of work also still happens in nations like India and Kenya. What makes these nations attractive for tech companies looking for workers to train their AI?
Yes, well, you're right. I mean, when we talk about, you know, a lot of humans being involved in these tasks, it might initially sound like a good thing. It's like, hey, lots of jobs are being created. But as Regine is pointing out, the model for offering these jobs is very much a gig economy model, which means people work as contractors. People don't have benefits, don't have access to, for instance, healthcare. So, and they just get paid very little because, as you're pointing out, a lot of this labor is recruited from the global south. People who are willing to work for very little money to do this very, very tedious work.
Regine, I'm wondering, like, why do you think companies in the West, specifically the United States, find the Philippines specifically attractive when looking for laborers to do this kind of work?
So the Philippines is a former colony of the U.S. And you know, we've been exporting labor for U.S. services from time immemorial. We have a American fashion education system. And so a lot of graduates from the Philippines are quite adept at English. And we also have a very young, digitally savvy population. We are also a very chronically online nation. We log on some of the longest hours on the web worldwide, top three at least. And so it's very easy for young people to adapt to the gig work economy and to the digital economy. Another thing that I'd like to note that I find interesting is that Filipinos have been very known historically for their labor. For example, care work, domestic work, healthcare, the service industry, seafaring, all jobs that require human touch and human expertise and human knowledge. So what's very curious to me is how Filipino labor is used for AI, but the branding of this product is something that's marketed as superhuman, as highly intelligent, as infallible, when it's not like that at all once you look at the supply chain behind it.
I did not realize that people in the Philippines were so online. You know, I read some reporting from Wired from 2023 that some workers outside of the U.S. doing AI training tasks are underage. And Regine, according to your own reporting, many have been underpaid. I'm wondering, Ulises, what kinds of labor issues have you seen arise in this kind of work through your research?
Yes, a lot of these practices, I think we're seeing them in the Global South, because it's easy to get away with this kind of unethical behavior. We keep hearing horror stories about other cases, for instance, when it comes to content moderation. Now, as we know, unfortunately, people post all sorts of disgusting, horrific, pornographic material on social media, mm-hmm. and these companies need to do a lot of work to try to filter out or block at least most of that content, if not all of it. Now, so far, you know, I think we've been hearing this narrative that, well, eventually AI will be doing all of that work for us. So, you know, that humans won't need to be exposed. But guess what? Right now, that kind of content moderation and filtering is up to humans, you know, to do that kind of work.
To like check and monitor and train AI to do it. Yeah, humans are still very much involved.
And so under the conditions that Regine is discussing, and we've been hearing some horror stories of individuals in Africa, in Asia, that have to spend hours a day basically looking at violent content, trying to weed it out, and being paid very little to do it. Sometimes they're actually hired under false pretenses.
Really?
Yes, they're recruited in one country, and they're told, come to this other country to do this work. It's going to be great. We can't tell you what it is, but, you know, it's AI related. And so people think this is a great work opportunity. Then they get there and they are put into a situation of, again, reviewing violent content 8 hours a day or more, being paid very little to do that, getting traumatized from this experience, because who wouldn't? And again, the thinking is that, well, it's okay because it's not happening in the United States or in Europe. So these people, we can exploit them. And if anyone complains too much, the companies who are doing this can just say that we're training the AI that will allow, you know, humans to be left out of the equation. Now, I'm not sure if that's going to happen. I think the idea is that, you know, eventually we can reduce costs by eliminating humans. But of course, as we're discussing, humans are going to continue to be the cheaper option in many of these cases.
We're going to take a quick break. But first, if any of you are finding It's Been a Minute for the first time, welcome. I hope you're enjoying the show and that you come back every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday morning for brand new episodes. And every Tuesday, a video episode. Tomorrow's video is with the hosts of the I've Had It podcast. And we are talking all about their personal political journeys and why they think some women are leaving the right. You can find that video on Spotify or YouTube, or just listen to the audio wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up after the break,
it's very much a Wizard of Oz type of situation where they sell this magic figure, but if you pull back the curtain, it's just a human behind it, or several humans, actually.
Stick around. So there's this idea that AI will eliminate drudgery, you know, that you can get AI tools to do all of these things that, you know, you find annoying or unpleasant or boring. But these jobs sound like they are absolutely full of boredom and drudgery. And they're essential to making AI work even a little bit. I don't know, there's like this narrative that AI works as if by magic. And hearing all this, I wonder what tech companies get out of people believing that idea instead of seeing all the work that goes into it.
I think the answer is simple. It's profit, really. It's very much a Wizard of Oz type of situation where they sell this magic figure, but if you pull back the curtain, it's just a human behind it, or several humans, actually. And these humans can make mistakes. These humans can be underpaid. These humans can leak data, whether on purpose or by accident. The training data can be heavily biased. And after you witness the way these digital sweatshops work behind the scenes in these remote back alleys in the Philippines, I've just become a huge skeptic of AI in general. I don't believe at all in this whole super intelligence, AGI, almost religious type of magic branding.
Well, yes, I think, you know, if we listen to the narratives presented by corporations, they would like us to believe that AI will, you know, cure cancer and solve the climate crisis and do all sorts of wonderful things so that we can stay home and be creative while AI does all the drudgery work. You know, I call them civilization narratives. We've been having this narrative since colonialism. It's like, this is what progress looks like. This is going to be for the benefit of humanity. And it's inevitable, right? You might as well accept it because this technology is here to stay. At the same time, as we're learning more and more, this infrastructure, the infrastructure required to build AI, is basically destroying our planet.
I mean, it's interesting too, because while I think a lot of people don't know about the workers who are processing data for monitoring or guiding AI systems, there are a lot of like American tech guys, CEOs, that get to seem especially smart, like they've built these magical tools that are going to change the world and solve all these problems. They kind of get a halo effect around them, while the actual people who are performing a lot of the fine detail work that makes this software usable, those people are being obscured. I mean, that feels like something to note here as well.
Yeah. You know, I mean, these technologies do have benefits. A lot of wealth can be created by building these things and selling these things. But I think the point here is that those benefits are not distributed equally or fairly. So I'm glad that Regine mentioned that Philippines is a former colony of the United States, because actually in the work that I do, my colleague Nick Caldry and I do try to understand what is happening with data in terms of AI, in terms of crypto, in terms of mobile phones through the lens of colonialism. What we are experiencing, basically, we're calling it data colonialism. And of course, readers might find it a little bit strange. It's like, why are we talking about colonialism? Colonialism is something that is in history books. It's over. But as I'm sure Regine from the Philippines or myself from Mexico understand very well, the legacy of colonialism is not over. Colonialism continues to impact our societies in very profound ways. Our argument is basically that whereas historic colonialism was about grabbing land, and grabbing natural resources, this new form of colonialism, data colonialism, is about grabbing this data, is about having human beings generate, annotate, and collect all of this data that is then used basically for two purposes, for generating wealth for a minority of people, and for enabling new forms of social control, as we're seeing more and more governments use this data, for instance, to surveil people, to target migrants who they think should be kicked out of a country, or to target individuals who should be executed through drones or missiles. You know, we're not saying historic colonialism looks exactly like this new form of colonialism, data colonialism. Of course, there are differences, but we're saying there is one very important similarity, and that is the function. The function of all forms of colonialism is to extract, to dispossess, to take something that doesn't belong to you and to use it to generate wealth for yourself.
Regine, do you feel like that comparison between historic colonialism of the past and data colonialism of the present, does that ring true to you as someone living and reporting in the Philippines?
Absolutely. The exploitation of Filipino labor completely has its roots in colonialism and empire. We've been exporting labor to the U.S. And then with the technology age, that took on a new form, you know, in the post-colonial society, which was largely through call centers, business process outsourcing. So people didn't have to leave the country for their labor to be exploited. And some forms of, you know, these post-colonial digital labor are more predatory than others. And data annotation has arisen as one of these possible modes.
It seems like there's kind of two prongs here. There's like a more classic understanding of colonialism that's still at play, like American capitalism was originally powered by chattel slavery and like built on free, stolen, extracted labor. And then even after slavery was banished, companies could pay Black Americans less, could pay certain immigrant groups less. Like the outsourcing of labor now in a more globalized era is still part of that pattern of seeking out workers that you can mistreat or pay less than is fair. But then there's this other concept that you brought up, Ulises, of data colonialism, meaning the discounted or unpaid extraction of data as a resource. And that's like a new tapestry within that pattern. And I think we see that with how a lot of people's written work or their music or other things they've made gets fed into chatbots like ChatGPT to train it without compensation. I mean, I even wonder if my voice, which is, you know, in hours and hours of public podcasts, has been used to train AI DJs or podcast hosts.
I wanted to jump on an example that you mentioned about how people's intellectual work was essentially being pirated or used without their consent to train this AI. And that's something that's happening in the Philippines as well, to much less fanfare, I would say, than in the West. When The Atlantic, for example, published its tracker of books that were used to train Meta's AI, I was unfortunately not surprised but appalled to find that there were a lot of Filipino authors and a number of Filipino academics whose work was essentially pirated to train the data. However, unlike in the West, where there are much more vocal groups or unions or authors associations and the like that can kind of stand up to or file, you know, legal cases against these companies and raise complaints, that kind of system, I would say, is not necessarily protected in places like the Global South, where intellectual property laws would potentially be weaker or people don't exactly understand how AI works and how extractive it can be.
You know, for the record, in response to a lawsuit from the New York Times, OpenAI, which makes ChatGPT, have argued that feeding articles to training models is fair use. And Joseph Gratz, an OpenAI lawyer, said regurgitating entire articles is, quote, not what it is designed to do and not what it does, end quote. In the example you brought up, Regine, there was a court case against Meta brought forth by a group of authors, which Meta won last year because a judge ruled the authors didn't prove AI would cause market dilution by flooding the market with works similar to theirs. However, the district judge who ruled in the case, Vince Chabria, said, quote, this ruling does not stand for the proposition that Meta's use of copyrighted materials to train its language models is lawful. It stands only for the proposition that these plaintiffs made the wrong arguments and failed to develop a record in support of the right one. What do you think of that?
Well, you know, I'm a teacher, and so unfortunately, sometimes I have to deal with plagiarism in my classes. And so there's different kinds of plagiarism. And one kind is, yes, if you take word by word something that somebody else has said and try to present it as your own, of course, that's direct plagiarism. But there are other forms of plagiarism that are disguised forms of plagiarism. So if you take something somebody else has said and change some words or modify it enough so that it doesn't look exactly like the original source, but you're still taking somebody else's ideas and not attributing those ideas to them, that is still a form of plagiarism. So to me, you know, when I have these discussions in my school, I do see AI as a plagiarism machine.
There's also, I would say, the matter of consent, the permission of these creatives, of these artists, of people who actually did the hard human labor of this work was not sought and that they're not compensated fairly, I think makes the claim of fair use very questionable.
Taking all of this in, is it possible for generative AI to be made responsibly? Like, is there a different path or is it based inherently on extraction or exploitation?
As somebody who is based in the Global South and who is seeing the ramifications of this kind of industry in the Global South, I'm not seeing yet, at least personally in the Philippines, a business model that is 100% not extractive in nature. However, there are, you know, some nuances sometimes to the kind of work that can make it less predatory. I would say that transparency would be one particular way. Being open about the kind of work that is being done, operating on consent, for example, is also another way of going about it, operating on fair labor, regulating the industry, which in the Philippine case has not yet been done, in part because government officials don't really understand this new industry and how to go about it. They were very surprised, for example, when we came to them with our findings of what Scale AI was doing. And I think regulating these industries is definitely an important step.
Can these technologies be built sustainably? Yes, in theory, but in practice, we're not seeing that at all. And sometimes I get a little frustrated because we do hear about interesting experiments. You know, people want to create a feminist AI or an indigenous AI. Or, for instance, I've been asked about a project called LATAM GPT, a Latin American version of GPT. And I think those are interesting experiments. But at the end of the day, if you're going to use those tools and apply them in the same way, which is to replace human labor with machines, and if you're going to build the systems by creating infrastructure that pollutes the environment and takes energy and resources away from communities that need them, and if you're not going to pay the people who contributed all the content to train those systems, it's like, well, what's the difference? I do think we can create forms of these technologies that are less extractive. I think maybe, yes, there are ways to use these technologies sustainably in a targeted way, in a way that doesn't require thousands of data centers, that maybe requires just a few data centers. But we're nowhere near that, and we're not heading in that direction today, unfortunately.
I really, really, really am grateful to have the two of you laying this out for myself and also for our listeners today. So thank you both so much.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.
That was Regine Cabado, a freelance journalist based in the Philippines, and Ulises Mejias, professor at SUNY Oswego and co-author of the book Data Grab, The New Colonialism of Big Tech and How to Fight Back. This episode of It's Been a Minute was produced by
Liam McBain.
This episode was edited by
Nina Patak.
Engineering support came from
David Greenberg.
Our supervising producer is
Cher Vincent.
Our executive producer is
Barton Girdwood.
Our VP of programming is
Yolanda Sanguini.
All right, that's all for this episode of It's Been a Minute from NPR. I'm Brittany Luce. Talk soon.